Counsel, let me make this suggestion, if this will clear up any uncertainty about what we think the issues are here today. First of all, as the clerk of the court ordered yesterday, the appellee's motion to reconsider granting the amicus El Salvador leave to argue is denied, but the appellee's request for an additional 10 minutes to present their oral argument has been granted. The motion to allow the international law and international human rights professors to become an amicus curiae is granted. The panel has had an opportunity to review their tendered brief. We don't, frankly, have any explanation as to why that was sitting in the clerk's office for months without any of us knowing. Finally, so there's no misunderstanding here. Last week, the court asked the amicus curiae El Salvador to submit an English language version of the country's 1993 amnesty law. Accordingly, the appellee's opposition to the filing of that law is without merit. However, the court did not ask El Salvador to submit English language versions of two decisions by the Supreme Court of El Salvador, so those two decisions will be stricken from the record. I'm not saying that you can't argue these matters that I just mentioned, but I am implying that that would be a waste of your time. So with that, how much time did you reserve?
If the court please, I'm going to argue for 12 minutes and save 3 minutes for Mr. Brook to argue and rebuttal.
All right, you may proceed.
If the court please, my name is Robert Ferguson from the Memphis Bar. I represent Colonel Carranza. This lawsuit has multiple issues in it, and of course, I'll only deal with a few of them today for that appear to be, to my concern, more important than some of the others, although they're all important. This lawsuit arises under the Alien Tort Claim Act and also under the Torture Victim Protection Act, 36 U.S.C. 1350. These occurrences happened in El Salvador during a time of civil unrest. They were brought against Mr. Carranza, who at the time was a colonel, and he served as the sub-minister of defense for 13 months from 1979 to January of 81, and then he served as the director of the Treasury Police from June 83 to May of 84. And these plaintiffs bring claims, particularly during that period of time, claiming that he's responsible to them and he's liable to them because of tortious acts, torture acts, acts of murder and crimes against humanity and other matters during that period of time. And although he was not directly involved in any and didn't even know anything about them, their claim is that as the commander of sub-minister of defense and as the commissioner of the Treasury Police, then he is responsible under the doctrine of command responsibility. There's only one claim, actually, that occurred during the time he was with the Treasury Police, and that's a claim of Daniel Alvarado that was the last case filed in this cause. And it was filed in, finally filed in 2003. Or the others were filed a year prior to that. The both of these acts, the statute of limitation has been limited to 10 years. In other words, the act itself says no action shall be brought unless it's brought within 10 years from the date of the occurrence.
Are you saying that you cannot toll that statute of limitations?
No, sir. I'm not saying it cannot be tolled.
Okay.
I'm saying that there are circumstances under which it can be tolled, circumstances under which it shouldn't be tolled, and in this particular case, we contend that the arbitrary date picked by the trial judge is simply an arbitrary date.
Okay, well, it was based upon the fact that that all the hostilities had ended down there in El Salvador and something of that nature, right?
Well, that's correct. In this particular case, the date that the trial judge picked was the date when elections were held in 1993 following the peace accord, which occurred in 1992. Now, in the Garcia case over in Florida, that judge picked the date of when the peace accord ended in 1992. If that same date had been used in the case in Memphis, in the Carranza case, then all of these cases would have been too late. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that that district judge was bound by the act of the other district judge. But my point is, it seems that in these cases, although equitable tolling applies, the courts have simply picked a date that's basically allowed the parties to file the lawsuit. And in this particular instance, and the Sixth Circuit has set up certain rules to evaluate whether or not a statute should be told, and also Congress has set up certain rules and guidelines for the statute to be told. And most of the reasons are that the defendant was in hiding or secreting himself, that there was immunity for the filing of the lawsuit, so it couldn't be brought, that the defendant hindered the parties from doing something that prevented them from filing the lawsuit. And it does say in extraordinary circumstances, and in this case, the judge used the idea of extraordinary circumstances, and that is these plaintiffs contended that they were afraid to bring any action for fear of retaliation against either themselves or family members. The fact of the matter is, however, they didn't even know they had a claim. They didn't even realize it until they were contacted and asked if they wanted to participate in a claim against Mr. Carranza in this case. So it seems a little bit disingenuous to me to claim that fear is a reason for not bringing a lawsuit when you don't even know that you have a lawsuit. And generally, ignorance of the law is no excuse. That's a long-standing issue in law that is still in existence in the law. In other words, if it was a statute of limitation in the United States in regard to an automobile accident and someone in New York wanted to file a lawsuit in Memphis, Tennessee, the statute for personal injury in New York is different from the one in Tennessee, but if they come to Tennessee and file a lawsuit where there's a one-year statute and they think there's a three-year statute, then they'd be out of luck. Nobody would say, well, the statute ought to be told because you didn't know the rule of the statute of limitations here.
Mr. Ferguson, let me tell you what I see to be the problem in your statute of limitations argument so you can have a chance to address that if you disagree. My understanding is that the district judge ruled on the statute of limitations issue on two occasions. One was in connection with a motion for summary judgment, correct? And for that, he was ruling on the basis of declarations that had been made. It also came up again during the trial, and both sides were allowed to put in proofs that went to the statute of limitations question. Is that correct?
Well, I suppose that could have been correct.
What do you mean, could have been? Either it was true or it wasn't true. There were proofs put in to the record during the trial as to this question of whether people reasonably feared reprisals.
No, there was no proof at all put in during the trial. I certainly didn't want to put it in and bolster their claim of fear.
Well, the district judge ruled in connection with your motion at the end of the proofs that his assessment of the testimony during the case strongly supported the determination of tolling. He must have been referring to something when he made that statement.
He was referring to the affidavit, Your Honor. That goes in.
That can't possibly be true, because what the district court said is, quote, before we get to the quote, he said he ruled before, but he hadn't he hadn't actually had anybody before him at that point. Then he says, after he saw the impact on these people, after having testified, he said, quote, I didn't think that it would be so severe. It has been severe on these individuals. That strongly supports the determination of tolling in this case. I did not see them or hear them before. I did not see the degree to which they were impaired as a result of the events. So what he's clearly tying his second ruling on tolling to was his observation, correct or incorrect, as to the impact of these events however many years ago on these individuals, even as recently as the time of the trial. That's what he said. Now, the reason I'm asking you about this is it would appear as if his final determination on tolling was strongly motivated by his observation of the witnesses and their demeanor during the trial. That being the case, I'm having difficulty figuring out why, where our role begins and ends in second-guessing his evaluation of their credibility during the trial on whether they did or did not fear reprisals, and that is or is not the reason why they delayed bringing the cause of action.
Your Honor, there wasn't any testimony about them fearing the reprisals. What the judge was talking about is the acts that occurred. In other words, the events that they were involved in, and he could understand how those events impacted them. But I submit, Your Honor, there wasn't any testimony during the trial from their mouth about them fearing to bring any type of lawsuit or the reason they didn't bring any lawsuit, and that's my point.
So what you're saying then is that his assessment of the impact of the incidents can't be anchored to a decision on tolling, and that's where the district judge went wrong in your mind?
Your Honor.
Okay, I understand.
That's my contention.
Thank you. You answered the question.
Because, Your Honor, he relied on the affidavits, and that was the position of the plaintiffs in the case, that they had given declarations, they had given affidavits, and in those affidavits, that was sufficient to prove the reason for the delay in the statute of limitations.
Is the statute of limitations argument what you think is your strongest argument here this morning?
No, sir.
Well, what is your strongest argument?
The strongest, I think, the amnesty.
Tell me what your strongest one is.
Sir?
Tell me what your strongest argument is, and perhaps we could turn to that.
Well, the amnesty argument is going to be made by the amicus, but I think the amnesty argument
is... All right. Of the arguments you're making, not somebody else, tolling is the strongest.
Well,
you can answer.
Okay, can I just quickly say...
You can say it as slowly as you want. The red light isn't on yet.
Excuse me?
The red light is not on yet.
Okay. One is the allowance of their expert witness, Terry Carr, to testify as a military expert. She had absolutely no training. She had absolutely no experience in the military. She was offered as a political science witness, and yet she was allowed to testify about command authority, military alignment.
Well, a lot of academics can be experts in military affairs, can they not? They read about history of Napoleon and his encounters and things like this. They can do that, can they not?
Well, Your Honor, an academic can be an expert in almost anything.
Well, I know, but they study these things, and I mean, even if they weren't in the military, they could still know about military tactics and command. That's pretty easy, isn't it?
Your Honor, I don't think she'd pass the Daubert test, which the court used to kick out our expert witness, Dr. Galindo, and not allow him to testify.
Well, did you ask for the Daubert test on her?
Yes, we...
Okay, and the court said she may...
be excluded, her testimony be limited to what she knew as a political scientist and not what she knew as a military, because she had no training or anything of that nature. All she had done is, at some time or other, talk to some military people.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Probably makes sense,
yeah,
doesn't it?
No, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Yeah, I'd like to argue for a minute and serve 9 minutes for the vote.
You're arguing 1 minute and reserving 9 minutes. We extended your arguments by 10 minutes so you could reserve 9 of the 10. Is that what you just said? Well, I'm not commenting on the merits of that decision, but you may.
May it please the court, Your Honors. I'm John Fionaga for the Republic of El Salvador. Not a single United States court, with the exception of the trial court in this case, a single United States court at any level, district, appellate, or supreme, has ever disavowed a foreign amnesty in deference to the Alien Tort Claims Act or the Torture Victim Protection Act. Not a single international case.
You almost suggest that somehow the United States acceded to and encouraged amnesty in your brief as I read it. Is that your claim?
It is, sir.
And here's what I don't understand in reading the entire material that's been filed. The peace accord is entered into on January 1st of 92. There's no question but that the United States was a strong proponent of the peace accord, correct?
Correct, sir.
The amnesty was not granted in accordance with the peace accord. The amnesty law doesn't come along until March of 1993, correct?
The amnesty law did come along in March of 93. The amnesty law...
Now, where is there any evidence in the record that the United States was in support of the amnesty law?
The Department of State has said as much.
Where is the Department of State in this action? The Department of State has not appeared in this action.
Your Honor, I cited to an official document of the Department of State, the United States information, quoting Peter Romero.
I'm guessing that you probably solicited the Department of State to support your position in this case, didn't you?
Yes, sir.
And they chose not to. So, I mean, we have what it seems to me the irony of the country of El Salvador coming to this federal court in the United States representing what Department of State's position is on the extraterritorial effect of the Salvadorian amnesty law when the official policy of the United States government is absolutely silent in this record. It's not here.
Your Honor, with respect, I would disagree that it's absolutely silent. The fact that the Department of State today, you know, 1 week before an election, elects not to enter an appearance in this case does not change the fact that in 1989, 90, 91, they were heavily involved with the peace accords, and they have stated on the record that this amnesty was a pivotal, in fact, the cornerstone of the peace accords.
But the amnesty that was the cornerstone of the peace accords was something that occurred according to the Truth Commission and what we've read in connection with the negotiations over the peace accord. There was supposed to have been an investigation. There was supposed to have been a determination of wrongdoing in a way that wouldn't prevent it again. There was supposed to then have been a process for finding of guilt and reparations, and then possibly pardons at the end. That's what was being discussed, as I understand it, in connection with the negotiations relative to the peace accord. That is a far cry from a blanket amnesty that occurs 2 years later in 1993, unless I'm just missing something.
Ron, I would not characterize it as a blanket amnesty. But there was a precursor amnesty, which was more limited, which didn't work. The hostilities continued. The Department of State is very clear that a thoroughgoing amnesty covering both sides of the political spectrum, or all sides, but really two, was an absolute prerequisite to the cessation of hostilities. The fact that it took...
Where do we find that? That's what I can't find supported in the record. You may be right, but where do I find it?
Well, Your Honor, it's in the remarks of Peter Romero, which are in an official State Department publication.
Okay, perhaps you could figure out where that is in the appendix, and when you come back, you could tell us where that is.
Your Honor, it's not in the appendix. Obviously, I've asked the court to take judicial notice of it. As an amicus.
So the answer then is there is nothing that supports this position that you're taking in the record of this case.
Not in the record. No.
All right, thank you.
Let me ask one question that when you started off, you said no court's ever found that this amnesty does not apply. Has any court ever upheld the amnesty from El Salvador in a proceeding in the U.S.?
No, sir.
Okay. So it's neutral right now. From that standpoint, you don't have any cases where it...
No, sir.
Okay. All right.
All right. Thank you. You'll have your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Matt Sendak, and I'm here on behalf of the appellees. 3 years ago, a jury in Memphis unanimously concluded that Colonel Carranza was responsible for the torture, extrajudicial killing, and crimes against humanity inflicted upon my clients. Colonel Carranza does not dispute that these acts occurred. He also does not challenge the jury's finding, based on the evidence before it, that he was responsible for these acts. He's instead arguing that the U.S. That the passage of time and the amnesty law should allow him to escape this responsibility. Now, Colonel Carranza's arguments both directly contradict and conflict with the fundamental purposes of the Torture Victim Protection Act and the Alien Tort Statute. First, to provide victims of grave human rights abuses with the United States forum, and second, to ensure that the United States does not become a safe haven for human rights abusers. Now, the government of El Salvador has argued that only in its brief, as has the appellant, that the amnesty law should prevent the application of the TVPA in the ATS in this case. But comity is the doctrine that was invoked here, and comity is an affirmative defense, the burden of which is upon the defendant to raise and persuade the district court.
Mr. Sandbach, let me ask you a couple questions about the mechanism of amnesty in El Salvador, assuming that these claims were being brought in El Salvador rather than a federal court in the United States. And these questions weren't readily apparent, at least to me, until we actually had a copy of the amnesty law before us. A little bit parenthetically, I would note it's a little inexplicable that this case turns perhaps in large part on the amnesty law that no party saw fit to provide to us until we requested it last week. It looks like, and this will give Mr. Kayanga a chance to think about this so he can address it if he chooses as well. It looks like in order to get amnesty under the Salvadorian amnesty law, there are a series of procedures that one would have to follow in El Salvador. First of all, they would have to file a motion or appear before a trial judge in order to get a certificate of amnesty. Is that your understanding?
That is my understanding.
Has the defendant done that in this case?
There's nowhere in the record that says he has.
So as far as we know in the record, there has been no finding by an El Salvadorian court that he is entitled to amnesty under the very amnesty law that's being pled in this case.
That's correct, Your Honor, based on the record in this case.
But that was not brought up at all in the trial court, was it?
No, it wasn't. With due respect, the Colonel Carranza's argument before the trial court was that there is an amnesty and it should apply. And as you mentioned, Judge McKee, he never presented the actual amnesty law to the trial court or presented any argumentation that the amnesty law applied to him in particular.
How would the trial court even know whether the amnesty law applied to him or not if he didn't have an English translation of it? Did the trial judge, was he fluent in Spanish or anything that we know?
The trial judge was not. The trial judge relied upon, again, based on what the defendant here argued, which is that there is an amnesty law and it should apply. The trial judge relied on an excerpt of the amnesty law that was cited in another case. I believe translations are also available online. But
did the question even come up then during the trial as to whether the particular amnesty law at issue here, the 1993 one, even covered this defendant?
That issue never came up. The defendant never presented that issue to the trial court.
But I take it you also didn't respond to the claim of amnesty by contending that he wasn't even covered by the amnesty law.
We did not. We can
just out of curiosity, why not?
Well, we thought the argument that the amnesty law shouldn't apply to foreclose these claims was sufficiently strong
that, in face of the argument that was presented by the defendant, that it wasn't necessary to go into those details. And again, the burden was on Colonel Carranza to persuade the court that the amnesty law should immunize the conduct or should not apply and should foreclose the court from hearing those claims.
Is the standard of review on this tolling, what is the standard of review here? Is it de novo or is it abuse of discretion or some kind of a clearly erroneous issue?
On the tolling or on the comedy issue?
On the tolling.
Tolling of the statute of limitations. Yes. And Colonel Carranza and we agree that the standard is abuse of discretion because there were disputed facts at the trial level.
Do you agree that the portions of the district court judge's comments that I was referring to earlier related to the impact of the incidents on these plaintiffs, both at the time they occurred and currently, and not on their fear of reprisals as Mr. Fragarson orders?
I do agree with that, Your Honor, that what the trial court was commenting on in that discussion was in direct response to a challenge on whether equitable tolling should apply. And the district court was...
So when you say you agree, what are you agreeing with?
I'm agreeing with the statement that the district court in that discussion was referring to the plaintiff's reasonable fear to take an action against Colonel Carranza, and that their testimony at trial convinced him or further persuaded him that they did have a reasonable fear, that a fear was reasonable to bring suit against Colonel Carranza.
So the impact of the incidents themselves, among other things, included fear that the judge at least believed to be recurring.
I think that's right.
Then he links that, I'm gathering, to the determination as to whether it was reasonable to expect them to have filed the claim earlier in El Salvador.
Correct. And the district court's decision on equitable tolling, again, under an abuse of discretion standard, it wasn't an abuse of discretion to find that equitable tolling applies in these circumstances, but it's an appropriate standard in a case just like this one.
Well, did they say that they really didn't know they had a cause of action at all that wasn't out of fear but just out of ignorance, as opposing counsel says?
The testimony is that they didn't know they had a claim, but what the district court found, and appropriately so, was that their fear was a fear to take any action against Colonel Carranza. So whether they knew they had a specific claim under United States law, frankly, didn't matter because taking any action against Colonel Carranza they would fear to take any action against Colonel Carranza up until the end of the tolling period, based on the circumstances in the case.
Did they still have relatives in El Salvador during all this period of time?
Each of the plaintiffs still had relatives in El Salvador, and Ms. Franco still lived in El Salvador at the time. And the district court's decision on equitable tolling was appropriate and fully supported by the evidence in the record. The fact the appellant raises the Arce case, but the Arce case did not decide fully and finally that 1992 was the end date that equitable tolling should apply. It's a very similar case. But what that court decided was that equitable tolling was appropriate at least until 1992, and that because of that, the claims in that case were timely filed. Here, the court had before it extensive evidence that equitable tolling was appropriate beyond that period. In particular, Professor Carl testified in the affidavit submitted with the summary judgment motion, or the response to the summary judgment motion, that the implementation of the peace accords in 1992 had only begun at that point, that the military was still had many persons who had committed grave human rights abuses, and essentially the same people were still in power that had committed the acts throughout the Civil War on the military side. And that's at Appendix 220. Professor Carl also provides numerous examples of specific incidents of violence between the signing of the peace accords and the 1994 elections. And I won't go through each of them, but on Appendix 221 through 220, extending all the way to 224, she recounts numerous assassinations of union leaders, which is typical, as the testimony showed, of how the military selected its victims. She recounts that even in the run-up to the elections, opposition leaders running for office were assassinated as well. So saying, in sum, the district court's equitable tolling decision in this case was fully justified on the record, and certainly not an abuse of discretion. And I think just to clear up the filing dates here, three of the plaintiffs filed their claims in December of 2003. Mr. Alvarado's claim was added in February of 2004. And that's at record entry 27 at 66 through 110 of the appendix. But going back to comedy, again, comedy is a well-recognized doctrine. And again, the defendant had the burden of showing to the court that comedy should apply. Did not do so, and essentially in an attempt to bolster Colonel Franz's argument below, the El Salvador as an amicus has attempted to put numerous facts before this court that, as the court acknowledged, are not in the record, are not in the appendix, and were not presented to the trial court.
What's your best case to show that amnesty from foreign country like El Salvador is not to be given any comity in this country?
I think it's the fact that this particular amnesty does not present a true conflict of laws with the TVPA and the ATS. A true conflict, as the Supreme Court said in the Hartford Fire Insurance case, occurs when a subject of those laws cannot comply with both simultaneously. So in this case, the plaintiffs were able to file their suit here. They could not file the same suit in El Salvador.
Is there any other court, though, that has had something similar to this? I'm not talking about the Hartford case exactly, but mm-hmm. something where a person has sued an official from another country and the other country claims amnesty. Do we have any cases at all on it?
None that were decided on comedy grounds. The government of El Salvador has cited a number of cases that were decided on a different doctrine, on political question doctrine, but none on comedy grounds.
Was the political question doctrine raised by the defendant in this case?
No, Your Honor, it was not raised below. Okay. And putting aside even the true conflict, comedy also does not apply here because Congress has expressed a very clear intent to regulate and provide claims for just these kinds of actions. The whole purpose of the TVPA, as I said earlier, was to provide a forum for claims for acts just like this. And furthermore, there are substantial connections of this case to the United States. The defendant, Colonel Carranza, has been a citizen since 1991. two of the plaintiffs are also citizens of the United States. So essentially what we have is a United States statute with between citizens of the United States and two aliens applying United States law, and simply comedy just doesn't apply in this case. And the district court was correct in finding that that was the case. Now the defendant has raised a number of evidentiary errors, but none of, and there are too many really to address in the time I have. So I just point out that the standard of review on those matters is abuse of discretion, and not only that, the defendant would have to show prejudice, that the error, the abuse of discretion would have changed the outcome at trial. And first, the district court made the proper evidentiary determinations. And second, the defendant has not shown that any in particular would have changed the outcome of trial. Well, I've covered essentially what I intended to talk about, and I'm happy if there are any particular issues that...
questions?
Well, for the reasons I've stated, we request that this court affirm the district court's order in all respects. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Bruce Brook, co-counsel with Mr. Ferguson, and I'm going to have 3 minutes for rebuttal. The issue of equitable tolling in the five considerations from the Graham-Humphreys case include the effect on a defendant. In this case, Judge McGee has extracted Judge McCallum's observation at the end of the plaintiff's proof, after them having testified that they were unaware of a cause of action, not until contacted by the Center for Justice and Accountability did they realize they even had a cause of action. The judge makes an observation that we have then filed for a motion to dismiss, motion for directed verdict at the end of their proof, that taking the proof in the most favorable light, there was absolutely nothing in the record of the plaintiffs having fear. To which Judge McCallum says, well, it's in the record. And what he was referring to was the pretrial affidavits, similar to what we've now had in Professor Carl's pretrial affidavit, or disclosure, of they had fear, which it was in response to our motion several times over in summary judgments, motions to dismiss.
So the ruling had actually been made pretrial, and this was just a kind of a reiteration
exactly.
Of the whole thing.
And it's not exactly analogous to a pretrial affidavit in a medical malpractice case. That I've got an affidavit, Judge, that the doctor says is a deviation from the standard of care. At the end of the proof, though, at the trial, there's no proof of that. Instead, the proof, uncontradicted, is they were unaware that they even had a claim.
Your side didn't ask for the jury to be given all this evidence anyway, though, did you? I mean, you wanted to stay away from that, did you not?
We weren't going to bring it up. We brought up the fact that they were unaware that they even had a claim. But the question is, Rule 1 says to accomplish substantial justice initially, we're talking about just, speedy, and expensive determination. And one of the considerations is the effect upon a defendant. Mr. Carranza has lived in Memphis, Tennessee since 1986, at the same address, same phone number in the phone book. He's been in the United States since 84. Terry Carl shows up and goes to El Salvador in 1983 and comes before this jury. Judge McCallum allows her to present photographs of atrocities, piles of bodies. The plaintiffs admit they could not associate Mr. Carranza with anything. The only person he had contact with at all was Mr. Alvarado, who, after Mr. Carranza, who was, as the proof showed in the trial, was associated with the CIA to try to assist the United States government in their actions there also, that they wanted to clean up the Treasury Police. He's there for like a month and a half, 2 months, and a American embassy officer, I believe it was, attaché, was killed. Mr. Carranza then gets notice soon thereafter that Mr. Alvarado had been captured and was giving, had given a confession. And the first thing he knows, he's asked to come to a public press conference where Alvarado gets up and describes everything. Mr. Carranza subsequently is asked by foreign press if they want to interview him, Mr. Alvarado. He asks Alvarado, would you like to do that? He does. The U.S. representatives or, of one of the offices of the United States had come down there. They wanted to interview Alvarado. He subsequently recants. And Mr. the proof unequivocally at trial, what happened, Mr. Alvarado? Well, Mr. Carranza came down to my cell and says, why didn't you tell me you had been tortured? And he admits that Mr. Carranza was mad. It was completely inconsistent with an idea that Mr. Carranza was in any way involved.
Mr. Brook, you're way past your time. Could you wrap up your thought, please?
I submit that, Your Honor, under basic fairness of fair trial, 10-year statute of limitation, lawsuit's not brought until 21 or 23 years after the fact. Overwhelming inflammatory evidence put in that record that has no relevance to Mr. Carranza. He's out of the country.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
The residents of three of the eight parties in the United States some 25 years after the action complained of, no, not nearly connection enough to make this a matter pertinent to United States court. The acts complained of occurred entirely in El Salvador. They had no effect here, and the actors were all Salvadorans. The Hartford case, which Appellee's counsel cites, was a case where the court found that the overseas action complained of was specifically intended to harm people in the United States. Not at all pertinent here. Not a single international case has disavowed an amnesty enacted to put an end to a civil war. Now, the Peruvian and Chilean amnesties were disavowed by the Inter-American Court. Those were vastly different. Those were amnesties unilaterally enacted in the middle of repressive regimes.
Mr. Kayanga, one of the problems with arguing for 1 minute and reserving 9 minutes for rebuttal is you're supposed to rebut something that the defendant, or in this case the respondent, said. It sounds to me like you're just making the argument that you should have made when you stood up first. What are you responding to?
Your Honor, he made general remarks about comedy, and I believe that what we're making is essentially a comedy argument, so I should be enabled.
Let's try to be specific on what he said, all right? But what is more important to me, frankly, is you're here representing the country of El Salvador. You're saying that there is an El Salvadorian law. It should be given extraterritorial effect when, from what I can see from the law, there isn't any indication that it was intended to have extraterritorial effect. But what really concerns me is that when we finally read the law, there doesn't seem to be any indication that this law would have even protected the colonel, had this case been brought in El Salvador. So what are we to make of this?
I'm not sure I understand the court's conclusion that it would not have protected him.
Well, one of the ways that the amnesty law protected people was to get them out of jail if they had been imprisoned during this civil unrest and not charged with anything. So there's a procedure, as I read it, that says if you've either been convicted or you're awaiting trial, when the law is passed, then the amnesty law provides that you be released and the warrants quashed under certain procedures. Now, that section of the amnesty law doesn't apply in this case, does it?
Correct.
So then it goes on to talk about unindicted persons or persons who want to benefit from the amnesty law to clear their name if they've been associated with atrocities. And if they haven't been indicted, and the colonel was never indicted in El Salvador, was he?
No, sir.
But he could at least argue that he wanted to use amnesty to clear his name. I can understand that. Then you have to go to an El Salvadorian court, as I read the law, and you have to file a motion or otherwise appear before the trial judge, and you get a certificate of amnesty. At that point, then amnesty applies to you. There's no suggestion that any of that ever happened in this case. So let's assume that we agree with your argument that we should defer to the El Salvadorian legislature and give comedy to the amnesty law. How does that help the defendant in this case? What is the result of that decision if we were to agree with you?
Your Honor, the claimant's claims should have been brought in El Salvador. Had they been brought in El Salvador, the relevant court in El Salvador would have been free to either find Colonel Carranza covered by the amnesty or to determine that the case was one of a quote-unquote fundamental human right, and therefore...
But Colonel Carranza is able to invoke the amnesty law, it seems to me, in at least two different ways. One is to have stayed in El Salvador instead of fleeing to the United States. The second is to go back to El Salvador and seek the benefits that you claim the amnesty law was provided. He didn't either. He left El Salvador, where he was then no longer arguably under the El Salvadorian law, and two, he hasn't gone back to El Salvador to claim the benefits to then seek to enforce those benefits in a United States court. So I'm just trying to figure out how the El Salvadorian amnesty law even cuts here.
Your Honor, first of all, I'm not sure he fled El Salvador, but...
That he left.
He left.
Okay, substitute left for fled.
But the procedure would have been put in place if the claims had been brought in El Salvador, which is where they belong. That's where these alleged abuses occurred. All the actors were Salvadoran.
But that's a different claim than you're making. Your claim is that this court should give deference to the El Salvadorian amnesty law. I understand that. When I ask you about the details of that, you then say, well, the claim should have been brought in El Salvador. I mean, maybe that would have been the better approach, but the whole purpose of the Alien Tort Statute and the Torture Victims Protection Act is to permit such claims to be brought in this country as opposed to the country in which they were brought. So it doesn't seem to me you're going to get anywhere on that argument. That's been foreclosed by Congress having adopted the two statutes under which this suit was brought, was it not?
With respect, I disagree, Your Honor. Neither statute specifically envisions a countervailing foreign amnesty.
Well, wait a minute. The Alien Tort Statute is not designed to cover the torture of aliens that occur in this country, correct?
Correct.
It's supposed to cover the torture of aliens in another country. Now, to simply say, well, they should have brought their claim in that other country, I mean, that may or may not be a good argument to make, but Congress has already provided the venue here to bring the claims here. So you're stuck with that.
Your Honor, the venue also exists in the country where the alleged ills occur. And
but where do I find in United States law something that suggests that we defer as I want you to disregard the amnesty law for a second. I want to go on to the argument you're now making, and that is we shouldn't allow the claims to be brought here. We should require them to be brought in another country. That's completely refuted by the existence of these two statutes.
Your Honor, there's an exhaustion of remedies claim, element to both of the statutes. Torture victim statute has an express requirement of exhaustion of local remedies. The alien tort claim...
Was there any claim made here in this case that there was an exhaustion requirement that was not satisfied? That when the words that you just spoke were the first I'd heard of that. Was that claim made in this case by the defendant?
Not to my knowledge.
So that's waivable. That's waived. So we're past that.
Your Honor... The Sosa case has been cited, at least by El Salvador, from the outset, and that suggests a requirement of exhaustion of local remedies in Note 21.
Is that jurisdictional under the statute, or is it waivable?
I would submit it's jurisdictional, Your Honor.
Do you have any cases that say that?
No, sir.
Was the argument even raised?
It was not raised, sir.
All right. So let's not spend a lot of time on that one. Or you may spend your remaining time on that if you wish.
I'm getting the court's drift.
But
the point is...
So aside from your argument that, gee, these folks should have sued in El Salvador, the exhausting argument, can you tell us, as an officer of the court, that this amnesty law, as it's written, even protects this defendant in the stage in which this case comes to us?
Yes, sir.
And what is the basis of that representation?
The basis is that the law conveys amnesty to all participants in the Civil War, all people alleged to have committed crimes.
Then why do you have to file a motion or appear before a trial judge in order to obtain a certificate of amnesty if it automatically applies?
Your Honor, I'm not sure that there's a same requirement that everybody who perceives that he or she might be vulnerable to a claim present themselves to a court.
Is that what not Article 4D and E say?
It does, Your Honor, but I don't think that's the exclusive means by which the amnesty can be acted upon.
Okay, so there's some sort of secret amnesty that's embodied between the lines in the statute. Where do I find the authority for that?
In El Salvador, criminal charges can be raised by private citizens. These plaintiffs could have gone to the relevant courts in El Salvador and said, I was abused in the following manner on this day. And that magistrate would have had the job of reviewing the case and determining whether Colonel Carranza was entitled to the protection of the amnesty or not. That would have happened with some result or another if the claims had been bought in the form where they were logically, where they logically should have been bought.
This is not a criminal case.
Your Honor, criminal and civil liability is somewhat conflated down there. People can sue for damages and also prosecute for or solicit prosecution of a crime in the same action. But
if you're seeking reparations, which is what was the case here, would you file in El Salvador a criminal charge?
You could file a complaint, style of criminal, civil, or both. But an individual has that capacity under the laws of El Salvador.
But you could style a criminal and still seek damages.
Your Honor, I'm not a Salvadoran lawyer. I do know that private citizens can initiate criminal suits in El Salvador. They can also initiate civil suits for money damages. And I know of no reason why the two cannot be combined in one action.
Any questions?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The case will be submitted. Interesting question.